This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, it is showtime here. Election season. First votes are tomorrow. The Iowa caucus. And we've been saying for about a year that, well, you know, it's still early. People are still making up their minds. That's no longer the case. We have with us two polling experts with specific expertise in New Hampshire. Andrew Smith is director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire. If, by the way, you read about a CNN poll in New Hampshire, these are the guys who actually did the work. And welcome.
Good morning.
And David Morris, a former vice president at Gallup, where he was editor of the Gallup poll for 13 years. He's also a former director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center and is currently a senior fellow at UNH. He's won an Epi, which is the online version of an Emmy, for his iMediaEthics.org blog on polling. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, let me set the stage, and I want to throw out the question. There is something first of all, it is more difficult to poll in primaries than it is to poll in the general election, and way more difficult to poll in caucuses like Iowa than it is in a situation where there is actual traditional voting. Why is that the case, Andrew?
The biggest difference is that there are no party queues. In general elections, most voters, Republicans or Democrats, are going to vote for their party, regardless of who the candidate is. But you don't have those party queues in primaries. And secondarily is that the candidates within a primary really don't hold issue positions that are very different from one another. So pretty much all of the Republican candidates are going to hold standard Republican positions on major issues, and the same is true for Democrats. And it makes it very difficult then for regular voters, people who are not political activists, to distinguish between these candidates on policy. So they have to rely on less easy to measure things like, did I like the candidate? Would they want to have a beer with them? Who's funnier? Who seems tougher? These more kind of ephemeral issues are things to try to figure out who they're going to vote for. And those things change up until the very end of the campaign.
David, your take?
Well, I think you were talking about the difference between primaries and caucuses. I think the problem, so just to go to that subject, with respect to caucuses, the turnout is so low that it's really difficult to get a hold of people who you know who are actually going to turn out. It's very expensive, too. If you only have 10% turnout, you have a response rate of around 10-15%, you know, that means that maybe 1% of all of the people that you dial, try to get a hold of, are actually going to be people who turn out in a caucus. So I think it's a much more difficult process to just technically to poll in a caucus than in a primary, at least specifically in a primary where there's pretty good turnout, which there is in New Hampshire.
Now, then why do we put so much weight on these? If you're thinking, okay, the first round is just who you want to have a beer with, who you like, who you don't like, maybe who aligns with you just a little bit, and we know it's so difficult to get a hold of people, and the polling is very difficult. Why do we put so much weight into Iowa and New Hampshire?
Because we don't have any other way of measuring who's likely to win, and we as human beings like to keep score. We want to know who's up and we want to know who's down. The reason that media organizations publish polls or broadcast polls is because they get higher viewership or they get better readership. And this goes back to George Gallup, who really sold the Gallup poll on the basis that their newspaper readership would go up if they published the poll. So, you know, the enemy is us because we're always looking for a way to try to figure out what's going on. Related to that is that the press, especially these days with 24/7 news coverage, is looking for content. They have to have something that they can talk about, and talking about polls is an easy way to fill some time on the air.
You know, the truth is, though, and I think Andy would agree with this, is that there's no real rational reason why the press should spend so much time on the polls, on the early contest, because the number of delegates is so small. The press pays a lot of attention because it's early, and in so doing, they give momentum to the candidates. But the truth is that they're only, you know, less than 1% of the delegates are decided in the first two contests. So what Ron really should do is, at least it's very difficult for the press to do this, but really should treat the early contest as really, you know, just the beginning, you know, like the first few minutes of a basketball game. You don't say, well, who scored first? And then say that's going to affect the outcome. And in fact, as we know with in 2008, that it took, you know, Clinton and Obama, you know, throughout the whole campaign period before it was finally decided, despite the fact that the early contests really got a lot more publicity.
But I think of one area in which the impact is huge. Take on the Republican side. We started out with 16, 17 candidates. My guess is after New Hampshire, traditionally we have about three. I used to say 2.5. But to be liberal, say three. Isn't there going to be massive attrition really quick after New Hampshire, if not Iowa?
Yeah, because I think at that point, everybody, we've come around to the consensus that if you can't win in the early states, it probably means you don't have much of a campaign. And so you all, there are several candidates who've fallen out because they don't appear to have any real electoral support. And although it may be unfair, that's the judgment that both the press makes as well as people who fund them. You know, the money, the people who have most of the money.
I think this year there are a number of people that are holding on to see how well they do in Iowa and New Hampshire. But I think after the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, you're going to see a significant number of people drop out.
So, side of polling, this is just the first time Iowa and New Hampshire, where we put so much weight on this, it's the first time people actually show up and pull a lever, so to speak, right?
That's how New Hampshire got to be important anyway. Back in 1952, when kind of the modern primary in New Hampshire came about, it was seen as the first place where people actually could register their support for a candidate for president.
Yeah, and as a consequence, New Hampshire got a whole lot of attention, even though the primaries didn't count that much during the period before 1972. Still, the results from New Hampshire gave an indication, supposedly a valid indication, of whether or not a candidate had electoral support.
We're speaking with Andrew Smith. He's the director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire, and David Moore, former vice president of the Gallup Organization, both co-authoring the book, The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Press Nominations. More about New Hampshire. What's really going on in New Hampshire when we come back right here in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back in the Think Tank with David Moore, former editor of the Gallup Poll, and Andrew Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Research Center. They are both New Hampshire-based currently and therefore experts in the focus of the world. Right after Iowa, we moved to New Hampshire. And I want to ask you a question, both of you, just less of a polling question, but more of a just life space, sort of like the whole world, the whole political world and all these candidates descend upon a relatively small state. How many of these guys have you had over to dinner in the last week?
None, thankfully. But it is, if you're a political junkie, this is like Disneyland. You have the opportunity to meet any candidate that you want. We see that about 10 to 20% of the population have said in polls that they have personally shaken hands with one of the presidential candidates during the last several election cycles. It doesn't mean everybody does, but if you're a political junkie, it's a whole lot of fun. It's the center of the universe. And as we actually get people that come to New Hampshire, essentially they're political tourists. They come to see the sites. They come to see what is happening. So it's fun.
You know, the other thing, and the funny thing about it is you're the center of the universe, and once that primary is over, it's like over, that's it. But you're not without consequence in that while it's a small state, it is one of 10 absolutely swing states in this country that could go in either direction.
Yeah, now it is. It is.
It used to be rock solid Republican.
Yeah, that's correct. But just get back to what it's like. It's a lot of fun if one wants to, you know, go see all the candidates. But there is the other aspect to it, that the if you have a landline telephone, it's ringing constantly. And if you have a cell phone, even then, you know, it rings not quite as constantly, but quite often. And there are people keep knocking on your door, and you always, you know, you have to go to the door and say, you know, I'm sorry, I don't support this person. You know, good luck on your way. And even despite the cold weather, there are a lot of people out there knocking on doors.
How many times have each of you been contacted personally?
Oh, too many to say.
I'm in a nice position because I can say, because of the polling work that we do, that I am nonpartisan, nonpolitical, and I'm not allowed to support anybody, so go away.
Well, ask you one question, both of you guys, about the sequential nature of our politics. We know where things stand right now. Pollster.com right now has Trump 32. This is New Hampshire. Kasich 13, Cruz 12, Rubio 11. So Trump in first and then three people behind. Sanders up by about 13 points. But there's one thing that's going to change between now and voting in New Hampshire, and that is we will have the results of the Iowa caucuses. How much of an impact do you think the results that get streamed from Iowa will have on how people vote in New Hampshire?
Well, I think on the Democratic side, it could be significant if Bernie Sanders, for example, pulls off what I think most people would say it would be an upset. I think the general consensus among the two parties right now, among the two candidates right now, is that Hillary Clinton may win by a small margin. But if she loses, particularly if she loses big, that could carry over. And Sanders is already ahead in New Hampshire, and that would just kind of solidify a support. On the other hand, if Hillary Clinton wins, I think you might see a big change here on the Republican side. I'm not sure that the impact of the impact is quite as great. What do you think, Andy?
I agree exactly with what David said on the Democratic side, that if Clinton is able to win Iowa, and particularly significantly win Iowa, that'll definitely help her here. But if Sanders wins out there, you know, it's going to be difficult for her to stop him in New Hampshire. On the Republican side, it's really unusual because the two electorates are extremely different. Iowa Republican caucuses are dominated by evangelical voters, low turnout, so it's activists. Churches organize the vote, whereas in New Hampshire, 45% of Republican primary voters say they're either moderate to liberal, they're more pro-choice than the country is as a whole, social issues don't matter, it's the second least religious state in the country. So all of the things that make a voter attractive to Republicans in Iowa really make them less attractive to voters in New Hampshire. And we've never seen a Republican other than a sitting president win the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary in the same year for that reason. The Iowa caucuses could have an impact in that they would winnow down the field of more conservative candidates, and that might make it easier for one of those people to survive New Hampshire. But I don't think it's going to make much difference in terms of who wins New Hampshire.
Let me ask you a question, peel back the polling curtain, if you will, as somebody who doesn't answer a phone number that isn't on my caller ID. What questions are you asking when you do call these people? What questions are you asking when you do knock on the doors?
It's a fairly standard list. I hate to say that the beginning of the poll is the most mundane and difficult part to get through, because we have to figure out if somebody is actually going to vote or not. So we have a fairly intensive screen that where we try to figure out who's going to show up or not. And it's really important to point out that you can't just go on who voted in the past as an indication of who's going to vote in the future. Just this week, some colleagues of mine at UNH here, we released a study that found that between 2008 and now, so just over 7 years, about 30% of the potential voters in New Hampshire are different people. You know, either they didn't live in the state or they weren't old enough to vote. So the first part of the survey is the most critical part in trying to figure out who's going to show up. We do ask questions about whether you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of this person to get a sense of whether a candidate's liked or not. We ask the horse race question, obviously. But one thing that David actually brought up several years ago, back in 2008, that we've continued to use is ask people as we ask people if they've definitely decided who they're going to support. And I think this is maybe the most important question that we report in our surveys, because what we routinely find is that most voters don't make up their minds till the very end of the campaign, and they don't really know who they're going to support even now. So in polling that we're doing now, less than 50% of Republicans, it's closer to 30% of Republicans, say they've definitely decided who they're going to vote for. And I think that's important for the press to focus on that rather than the horse race.
Well, I think that I really like the fact that Andy adopted that question. And the reason is that when you take a look at a lot of the polls, they indicate is almost as though, you know, 85 to 95% of the people have some kind of a fixed opinion. And the fact is that the opinions are not gelled. They aren't anchored yet. They are kind of top of mind opinions for, as in this case, maybe over half of the people who respond, which suggests that there can be a lot of movement. And it's not because people are faking it or because they're really, unsure about what they're doing. It's just that, in fact, most people in the state haven't made up their minds yet. Only in the polls, when you use a forced choice question, you say, do you support X or any X or Y or Z? You don't usually say, or don't you have an opinion? But Andy asks it right up front, so he gets how uncertain people are. Then he asks the forced choice question, which I think is good because it allows you to make some assessment of how solid are the results that you're reporting.
We're talking to the two men behind the curtain in New Hampshire, Andrew Smith and David Moore. We're talking all things caucus. When we come back, let's get down to these numbers and see what they mean. Let's see their opinions of what they see happening in Iowa and New Hampshire right here on the Think Tank, KTAR News.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with pollsters Andrew Smith and David Moore. First thing, I just want to jump in with a thought. Both of you guys seem to think that Hillary has a slight lead in Iowa. I'll take that one on an even money bet if you want. I'll cover it. I think Bernie Sanders is going to pull it out. If he doesn't, I think his campaign's almost over. He needs a 1-2 punch. But you can respond to that one off the air. But I wanted to kind of amplify to make sure people got it, because I think it's really important. The research that David cited, I've used this in speeches for years. This was a study where you took and did a split ballot experiment. And look what happened when you asked the question, well, have you made up your mind first? And you get the vast majority not making up their mind, and very small numbers of people making up their mind in December and early January. And then you compare that to just if you ask the question and you get everybody giving an answer, but it's about as solid as mush.
Right. And I think that gives a misleading impression. So it looks as though the electorate is really volatile, but it's not. I think it's because a lot of times the polls are measuring not opinion. Either they ask you, do you have an opinion? And because you're in the poll, you're expected to come up with an answer. And since they don't say, or don't you have an opinion, don't you have a choice, they'll come up with an answer, but it'll be top of mind, and it could very easily change. And I think a lot of people, even when people say that they have made up their mind, what Andy said earlier, I think, is very important to keep in mind. A lot of the candidates are so close to each other that the voter has a great difficulty in choosing between them. And I think, you know, that's particularly true in the Democratic Party of this year. I think people could vote for Bernie Sanders or for Hillary Clinton. It's hard, or, you know, Martin O'Malley, as it turns out, except that he doesn't have the national stature. But, you know, their position differences, their positions are not that much different from each other. And I think that's true with respect to a lot of the Republican candidates, although since there were so many, there was probably more variety.
Well, what I found extraordinary about that story, and you did this when you were back at Gallup, and you took it to your media clients, and you showed 70% of the people had not made up their mind, and nobody else was in double digits, and they said, we can't run this.
That's right.
Because it's not a very sexy story.
It's not interesting.
Yeah.
People would say, why are you doing a poll if 70% of the people haven't made up their mind?
Well, you asked us to do a poll, and that's where people are. And
well, from the outside, I think that that's actually the sexy part of the poll. I think that 70%, if 70% of America says, I don't, you know something, we haven't made up our minds yet, I think that's good, that's positive. I would run with that story all day.
Well, the problem is it's sexier to run saying Trump dominates field as opposed to saying, well, most people really have no idea who they're going
to
vote for.
And it's just fun to say everybody's feeling the burn.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that is absolutely the case. We really worked hard back in 2008 to make that point to our media sponsors at that time, with CNN and the Boston Globe. And I really give them a lot of credit for saying, yeah, that does sound important. Because what we try to do is reflect what public opinion is, or our best assessment of what public opinion is. And if public opinion is, I don't know, or I don't care, that's what we should be focusing on, not try to make up a story just for the sake of having a story.
Okay, on the subject of accuracy of polls, probably the most dramatic illustration where the polling numbers diverged most substantially from the actual result was the 2008 New Hampshire Democratic primary. Basically, it looked like Barack Obama was going to carry it by landslide, and Hillary Clinton pulled it out. What is your best, after the fact, years after the fact, to study it, assessment, both of you guys, of what happened then?
Well, let me start off with that, since we were guilty as along with everybody else.
It wasn't just you, it was everybody.
Yeah, and right. And no poll predicted Hillary Clinton would win. The average margin was that Obama would win by 7 percentage points. And Clinton won by 2.5. Well, we had egg on our face. There, people were saying this was a polling fiasco. But I went back and looked historically at previous primaries, and it was by no means the worst indication of primary polling being inaccurate. For example, in 1984, polls predicted that Walter Mondale would win fairly easily, and he lost by 10 percentage points. This has been going on for a long time. Arizona's perspective, in 2000, the polls showed that on average McCain would win by 8 points, but he won by 19. So inaccurate polling is routine, not unusual. And the reason for that is, goes back to the point that David and I were talking about just a minute ago, is that voters haven't made up their mind. Exit polls show routinely that upwards of 40% even of voters make up their minds in the last 3 days, and upwards of 20% make up their minds on election day. So when we ask people on the weekend before the election who they're going to vote for, they may tell us one candidate or another, but they really aren't locked into those candidates. They haven't made up their mind, and polls are more often or as often wrong as they are right in New Hampshire.
I have a question about that. This, you know, with the margin of error, how much margin of error do you give people that say, like, go back in 08, that said, because it was cool to say they were going to vote for Barack Obama. I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. He's the new guy. It's time for this country to have a black president. And they knew in their heart they were going to vote for McCain. How many people just say what they think everyone else wants to hear?
Well, there was no evidence in the follow-up studies that looked at the polling in that year that actually happened. The biggest issue, I think, is the elephant in the room, and frankly, the one that a lot of people in the public opinion research world don't want to face, is that we're asking people about something that they really haven't decided yet. We're asking people to say what they're going to do, and they don't know.
And here's another thing to keep in mind. Although I think I forgot how long ago it was, in around 1993, 94, the Doug Wilder vote in the people thought, or the Bradley effect. And
these are both black. Just in case somebody missed the point, these are both black candidates whose vote was underrepresented.
Yeah, black candidates and people not willing to admit that they'll vote against them, particularly Democrats, if the black candidate is a Democrat. But you know, it was interesting, because Obama's support in South Carolina following the New Hampshire primary, he was expected to win by about 8 or 9 percentage points, and he won by almost 20. The margin of error, that is the actual difference between what the average of the final poll showed and what the results were in South Carolina, was larger than the error in New Hampshire. Now, of course, the winner was the right winner, but his margin was much greater. And that, of course, was a margin where they underestimated the black vote. So in the other, in New Hampshire, they overestimated the vote for a black candidate. So I don't think it's really black candidate or not. I think it has more to do with momentum, has more to do with people making up their minds at the last minute, at least now, and not having much to do with the fact that people aren't saying the truth or telling the truth about who they're going to support.
I think the other thing is South Carolina Democratic primary has a huge black vote. And if you recall, in the beginning, blacks were not convinced that Obama could win. And after Iowa and New Hampshire, I think he had a level of credibility. And
yes,
that's when you saw a swarm of black votes moving from Clinton to Obama.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Right.
I want to ask you, what post-New Hampshire, how much is there of a groundswell effect? If somebody does a 1-2 punch, say Sanders wins both Iowa and New Hampshire, does he get a huge national bump out of that?
I think yes. I think they do. Historically, it's been the case that winning New Hampshire is really critical to winning the election. It's extremely important. Nobody's won their party's nomination in the modern primary era without finishing either first or second in New Hampshire. So you've got to do really, really well in New Hampshire. And part of that is because after New Hampshire, the field gets much smaller. The campaigns are much more condensed, and you have multiple states at the same time, and you're much more reliant on media momentum than you are on an actual campaign going forward. So winning in New Hampshire gives you that momentum and the press coverage that allows you to carry your campaign going forward. And not winning New Hampshire isn't necessarily fatal, but boy, does it make it a lot more difficult.
Better come at least second, I'd say.
Yes.
Well, I don't think O'Malley's threatening anybody on the Dem side, so I think one or two on that side, I think it's a lock for that, right?
Yeah, I think he'll stick around maybe for New Hampshire, and then he's out.
Andrew Smith, the director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire, and David Moore, former vice president of the Gallup Organization, both co-authors of the just-published The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. Where can we get that book? Can we find that on Amazon, guys?
Yeah,
sure can.
Yep, you
all
can.
Right. Get out
there. Hey, David, plug the. David's also a novelist. Plug the novel.
Oh, I don't have. No, it's not published. I haven't got it published. Thanks.
Okay, nope. We'll have you back on to plug that one. Thank you guys very much for visiting with us. Thank you for the time. We really appreciate it. Doc and I are going to tie a big red bow around this when we come back right here on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Big thanks to our polling rock stars, Andrew Smith and David Moore. Definitely invaluable information because tomorrow's the day. It's caucus time. Here we go. It's on. No more of this. Well, we'll see. We'll see if they're still around in a few weeks. This and that. I mean, it's game time. Here we are. This is when the first shot is fired, and it's on in Iowa, and it's tomorrow.
Yeah. And particularly on the Republican side, you're going to see a massive exodus of candidates.
Well, sure. You can't see a massive exodus. We hope we don't see a massive exodus on the Dem side, because of which there are three.
There are three. I think you're going to lose one.
Yeah, of course. You're going to lose one, and that's fine. And then he'll start bucking for a cabinet position somewhere.
He may have got himself one. O'Malley's comported himself well, but he never broke through the threshold of credibility.
Which, in my eyes, and of course, everybody can differ with me. That's fine. Of the three, I wanted him. That guy seemed most qualified and had the best resume to run for president of the United States. It was just me, but it was just like on the Republican side, where it's the Trump Cruz show. It was the Clinton Sanders show. Over
the
there.
Interesting thing is what's going on now in the back rooms of the Republican establishment. They basically decided that Trump was going to be a disaster, and then it looks like he's inevitable. And then they were starting to accommodate for him, but the recent kerfuffle about the debate has all of them wondering again, and they're sort of back to the drawing board and, you know, picking a fight with Fox News. And Roger Ailes is an interesting strategy.
I think it's been his
brand all along. I stand up to everybody.
And that's fine. But understand that I think everyone out there needs to understand that it's very little to do at this point with the candidates themselves. It's the backing in the media and the money backing behind each of those candidates that's really keeping their momentum and pushing them through.
And the thing to understand about Trump that has persisted is that he has absolutely dominated the coverage.
Yep.
And, but those of you who think that this is a that all media is a conspiracy don't realize how powerless the media is. They sort of go to the shiny object.
Yes, absolutely.
And Donald Trump not only started out as the shiny object, he has continued to throw bombs out there that has made it impossible for the media not so. And I'm not just talking about the fact that they're covering. I'm talking about he's getting 80, 85% of all the coverage because he's done stuff that's outlandish.
Let me bring that up.
It's like an auto accident. You can't not look at
it. Let me bring that home. Like if we right here on KTR.com, if we throw Trump top art on our website, click loco. Everybody wants to see. Everybody wants to read. What has he done? Back in the Arias days. Remember Jody Arias?
Yeah.
I remember when we'd get all these emails. Why are you covering this evil woman and giving her all of this attention? Because when Monica Lindstrom wrote an article about Jody Arias from the courtroom, guess what? Everyone in Arizona and Maricopa County wanted to see what that was all about. We like that. We don't do that. There's no conspiracy.
Absolutely
we don't get behind,
not.
Oh,
yep.
You know, we're gonna put her up on a pedestal. No, we give the masses what they want, period.
And the media.
Like here's this what, show the, right the, here. The, that's what yeah, the masses yeah. want. That's
well,
what I'm saying.
The media is, in effect, helpless before they get attracted to a shot. I mean, everybody knew in this newsroom knew that Jody Arias wasn't the most significant thing going on in our country, but they couldn't help themselves.
Right. I have to defend us. I have to defend us as the media because we screw up. We definitely screw up. We don't want to put she's not a mass murderer, murdering idiots up on a pedestal. We never want to do that. But if everyone wants to know what's going on, as evidenced by the ratings, as evidenced by the clicks online, guess what? We're going to keep giving
and
it.
And this is nothing new. This is O.J. Simpson.
Sure.
This is Patty Hearst before that.
Have we found Flight 370 yet?
Yeah.
CNN ran wall-to-wall with that for, a month?
And their ratings went through the roof.
90% spike.
Even though 98% of the coverage was there, and you read through what they were saying, it was, we don't have any more information.
Nope, no information.
But here's somebody holding a press conference,
right.
And they don't know anything more, but they're telling us that they don't know anything more. And
they held that breaking news banner at the
breaking
very bottom,
news.
And you know what? Everyone flipping through the channels, guess what they did?
Breaking
they
news.
They stopped.
No new information, folks.
But we have a lovely flight simulator here that we can jump into. But going back to what's going to happen tomorrow, I don't think it's going to tell us a lot on the Dem side because either one that wins or loses in Iowa, guess what? It's like, we knew it was close.
Unless it's
a landslide.
I think I'll disagree.
Okay.
Here's what it is. I think if Bernie Sanders wins, and I'm talking about there's a winner and there's a loser.
Correct.
And win by 1%, it's Sanders beats Hillary Clinton, and then he goes on to win New Hampshire. That's two in a row. He gets a big bump from that. If he loses in Iowa, he still might win in New Hampshire, but then all he's done is a split decision, and she likely runs through a series of victories after that, and it's over. Sanders needs a 1-2 punch, and if he gets it, he will get a bump of unknown size.
Here's what I've seen. I've seen with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and I've seen with Nancy Pelosi. Okay, the two queen bees of the DNC, right?
Two of your favorite people, right?
Okay, right. But side of my feelings on those two women. I see this because they were both asked point blank that what if Bernie Sanders takes 1 and 2? What if he takes Iowa and New Hampshire? Did not blink an eye as if the answer was already loaded. Nevada and California right on their heels, and we're confident that our candidate will carry those. They have already crowned Hillary the winner. Yeah. They're not looking at Iowa and New Hampshire, so I don't think she bows out even with a 1-2 punch.
Oh, no, she doesn't bow. Absolutely not. I'd still probably rate her the favorite, but what will happen is there will be a spate of media reports. What's the matter with the Clinton campaign? Is this 2008 take two? Why don't people trust Hillary Clinton? You will get a spate of media on that, and she will have to turn it around. I would still take an even money bet on her, even if she loses the 1-2, but it will be her inevitability will be called into serious question if she loses both of them.
And I think in Iowa, it's funny because it's about winning and losing, because she's either going to win by a little or lose by a little. Iowa's not going to be a blowout.
I honestly don't think that people realize that Bernie Sanders is the Donald Trump to the DNC. Sanders is to the DNC what Trump is to the RNC. He's a thorn in their side, and they've already crowned Hillary the winner, and now here comes Bernie Sanders. Oh no, what do we do if he starts winning primaries?
Yep.
And that's the same thing with the RNC. What do we do when Trump starts taking these things and running the table?
I don't think it's exactly parallel, but it's clear Hillary was the anointed preference candidate.
Right.
Has all of the endorsements, mainly due to inevitability resume, which is impressive. Trump is clearly not a Republican mainstream. He has not. He's been a Democrat most of his life.
Right.
They've got some of the most devastating tapes to conservatives are Donald Trump talking about how he's pro-choice and how he gave most of his money to Democrats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bush has run that commercial several times, and there's a lot more stuff out there because he has not been a Republican conservative guy. But, he's talking tough right now on immigration.
He's not the buttoned-up Marco Rubio that they're looking for.
Yeah, Rubio's kind of the safe guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
And that's what he's been safe with. What that meant is occasionally he's shown a propensity to compromise, and to the far right, that's fatal.
Well, sure.
In a general election, that's
strength.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And where Rubio probably polls the strongest against Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely, he does. Because it's sort of the McCain phenomena. The conservatives didn't like him because occasionally he worked with Democrats, but that made him a stronger candidate in the general.
And still ran the worst presidential campaign.
Well, I mean, that's the tactics of the campaign.
And
he had that Hail Mary pass that didn't work out so well either.
I don't know what you're talking about, that Hail Mary pass.
That was.
All right, my prediction, your prediction for the game, Bab. What do you got over there? What's your prediction for Iowa and New Hampshire?
Iowa, Trump is an easy call. I'm going with Sanders, despite what we've heard, and I think
it's going to be tight, though. Squeaky or no?
It'll be close. Yeah. Again, I like Trump, and Sanders is an easier call, unless he gets shellacked in Iowa than he might. But I think Sanders does the 1-2. I still think he's the underdog candidate after that, but he'll get a nice little bump.
Who's 2 and 3 in Republican side?
2 and 3. Rubio is. I mean, Cruz
Rubio.
Cruz is easily
Trump,
number 2.
Cruz Rubio is what we're going to see.
Trump Cruz Rubio is a basic layout.
And this will be the last whimper
level
of the Bush dynasty after this.
They need an establishment candidate. It could be Bush. It could be Kasich.
Maybe we'll check it out. All right, we'll see what happens. And trust me, we're going to cover it all right here on KTAR News. Thanks for spending some time with us in the think tank.